If you have your Bibles, I want to invite you to turn to a very, very familiar passage, and one of the imperatives that Jesus gave his disciples is found in Matthew chapter 28, verses 18, 19, and 20. Very familiar. And we understand it. We've heard it. We've seen images depicting the whole concept. And I will not have anything new to say, but I think we just need to be reminded again that this was one of the statements that Jesus made to his disciples, one of the imperatives that was made to them and through them to us of what needs to be characteristic of our lives as faithful followers of Jesus Christ. We need to try to get our arms around this. And I have to confess, this is a difficult one for me. I know it. I've been involved in it, and yet there are times where I find myself struggling with doing it, or at least being zealous in doing that. So let me read the passage, and then let me share some things just as I've looked at the passage and some thoughts that I have. Let me begin with Verse 16, but the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had designated. And as Jesus was concluding his ministry, he had sent them on up to Galilee and said, wait for me there, and up by the sea, and a setting in which was very familiar. And he says, I'll meet you there. So they have gone on up, and then in verse 11, and when they saw Jesus, they worshipped him, and yet there were some who were doubtful. And it may be that they were doubtful of his authority. This was a large group. It wasn't just the 11. It was a group of his followers. You remember at one time he sent 70 out to share the good news, and he sent them out in pairs. And so we know that there was a very large group that was with them. There was the group of 11 now, 12 before Judas betrayed him and then took his own life. But at this point, you know, and there was the group of Peter, James, and John. But in the midst of all that was this large group following, and some who were still skeptical. They weren't sure. And as Jesus came to them, he made these statements. And Jesus came up and spoke to them all, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And Jesus, as he begins with just identifying the authority that's been given to him. And they all understood, all authority rested with God. And Jesus is identifying and assuming and has accepted their worship. He, again, has done nothing but demonstrate and to accept the adoration and worship of those that would be there to worship God, and is verifying to them he is God. But he is also in the process of this saying that God the Father has given me authority in heaven, and he's given me authority here on earth. And with that authority, I am now delegating responsibilities to you. And that is, you need to be, as the passage says in here, you need to be going, making, teaching, baptizing. There's really four tasks there, but there's one imperative, and the imperative is the making of disciples. The rest are participles, which are assumptive, but because of being connected with an imperative statement the way it is, they pick up an imperative nature, so that it's not only as you are going, it is as you are going, because you need to be going. And that's all of us. We need to have that concept that we are going to be about the process. And as we are, we need to understand God's authority rests in Jesus, and it's expressed through Jesus, and it's mediated by Jesus. That his authority is being poured out, being shared, and in a very short time, that authority is going to be very graphically demonstrated as it is poured into the lives of the disciples. But in this is this whole concept that we are on task. My aunt was just here. I love my aunt dearly, but she is not a big purpose-driven church concept fan. And I go, Aunt Betty, What are you living your life for? She says, to share Jesus. You're purpose-driven. She says, no, I'm not. I'm living to serve Jesus. I said, you got a purpose. She goes, I don't want to talk about it that way, you know. But the reality, I go, okay, you know, we won't. I look at Barbara. You know, and she says, I saw that. But the reality is, Jesus is saying, live your life with meaning. Live your life with purpose. Live your life for me. We need to understand what that means. And most of us that have been Christians for years, the way this room is, we have given our lives to that. That's what we want. This isn't new, but sometimes the exercise of it is. You hear these stories of people sit down on a plane and immediately begin conversations with the people next to them. And they have these. In fact, Aunt Betty can remember sitting and sharing with a person sitting next to her that was reading their Bible. And as the conversation went on, the person on the other side was listening and was having lots of trouble in her life. And as this little boy that was sitting next to my aunt, I don't know if she traded places or just talked past, but this girl began to ask my aunt questions. And my aunt just, you know, I get on the plane, the headset goes on, the Kindle comes up, the eyes go closed, and the Kindle drops in my lap, and I listen to my music, and Barb hits me in the side and says, turn it off, we're starting to land. And I just, you know, I hibernate while I fly. Not because I'm afraid of it, because I think it's a good time for a nap. You know, but there are people that are, you know, they're looking for the opportunities because they always see themselves on process of going. And as Jesus comes to them, he's really saying that we are to be going. And that's easy. We live in a world where we go. You know, this morning I got up and I went to church. I came up here. And after church, then we went out to eat. And then after we went out to eat, we went home. And after we were home for a couple of hours, we came back. And when this is over, we're going to go someplace else. And, you know, we're going to go back to the house. Tomorrow morning, we'll get up. You know, we understand going places. We just need to connect the two that while we're going, that we're going there as delegates. And, you know, if you watched the conventions when they happened, one of my first memories of coming to California was the Eisenhower-Stevenson, the conventions where they both were nominated to be the individuals running for the presidency back in the 52 and all. And sitting there watching this on TV, thinking, there's got to be a cartoon on. But you know, I was in second grade at the time, and watching, you know, my aunt is watching and wanting to see who's going to, and all that was going on with that. And I can remember watching all that. But we get used to conventions. And when we see the conventions, you know, you've got all the Texas delegates over here. And that's an entity unto itself. And then you have the other delegates and all that are all around. And, you know, you see them, and they all got something to identify them where they're from. You know, they got crazy hats, or they got banners, or they got banners and crazy hats and everything else. But, and I'm thinking, that's cool. I could do that in the convention center. But they go outside, and they've got their buttons and their badges and their crazy hats and their banners, and they walk around the town that way, proclaiming what it is they're there for. That's the concept that Jesus is talking about. When you're there, you're going. And while you're there, you just need to see yourself as on task and having the opportunity. When the early church was being persecuted, you know, and early on after Jesus' death and his resurrection, the church was kind of just accepted. They would get up, they'd go over to the temple, and they would have their meetings, and they were seen as being just an offshoot of the Jewish faith, and Rome wasn't too upset and concerned about it at the time, and as it played out, more and more it began to become an issue, because the Jewish people began to understand, this is big, this is not us. So it developed persecution, and it started to spread people out away from Jerusalem. And as they went up to Caesarea, as they moved on up to Antioch, and as they began to be dispersed, and as people in Rome that had been in Jerusalem during the Pentecost and time, and they maybe had been touched by the gospel, and they go back to Rome, back to their cities, and they started to experience the persecution that Rome began to exert on the region and on Christianity and all. They began to spread out more and more. As they spread out, they just shared. And they saw themselves wherever they were, that was where they were going. And that was where they needed to be. And that was where they were on duty. Paul, the early disciples, the early church fathers, wherever they found themselves, they saw that as their opportunity. And they saw that as the place that they had been sent. You remember the early pioneers. This morning, I don't know if Jack brought it up in here about the Puritans or not. Okay, Jordan brought up about Puritans over there. That they came to America very, very strict religious adherence. But the Puritans were very concerned about whether they could lose their salvation or not. That was always at work in their lives. But as they moved to the New World, and as the colonies developed, and as the westward movement started to happen, very quickly, as believers were moving, looking for a better life, as they got into these settlements and all, one of the very first things that they would do in the community setting was they'd build a church. And then there were itinerant preachers that were circuit riders that would come around and preach. And if a city or a community was really large enough, they were thrilled, they might have a resident minister. Very early on, especially coming across out of Kentucky and some of that region, you had lots and lots of Methodist circuit riders that were out and about, that were sharing the gospel and preaching. But they would build that, and then it would double as a school. Cracks me up. You know, in the early days of the West, we built churches and let the schools meet in them. Now when we build schools and we don't let the churches meet in them very often. But, you know, that's what happens in a fallen world. But the pioneers were on mission. They were always looking. And Southern Baptists, as they began to move out of the South, they'd move into a community, they'd look around and they'd see good churches and all and go, but there's not a Southern Baptist church. So they would start a Southern Baptist church. And that would move, but they wanted to do it because they saw themselves called with purpose. And that's what Jesus is really saying, is as we live our lives, just see ourselves always on task. It's not that we have to be the ministers. The best mission programs are the people themselves that get excited about their faith. It's the individuals like Jeremy Minney, who doesn't know he's not supposed to go tell his friends that he just became a Christian and that he's so excited about it and it's transformed his life. So he goes out and talks. I mean, we haven't trained him yet. It's like, okay, who calls Jeremy? Calls him in and says, sit down, we need to talk to you, bud. You can't do these things. No. But sometimes we get that mindset, you know, oh, we can't do that. And Jeremy's just out there sharing. He's got the gift of evangelism, too. So that just has made it that much easier for him. He's just, you know, out there doing it. It's fun to watch. And we had a neighbor that lived across the street from Barb and I. And we really liked him, but we really liked Ginger, his wife, and his daughter. Dick was about this tall. You know, I mean, we saw eye to eye. I scared to death of Dick. I mean, we'd high and everything, and we actually met on the roof of my house when the fire almost burnt down to our house, and when it was out, all of a sudden, it's like, what do you do? I mean, everybody's been scurrying around trying to save their houses. So my neighbor and Dick and the three of us ended up sitting up on my roof watching the fires over burning during the evening and watching trucks respond. I mean, and we got to know one another. And then it was like, you know, we really need to invite Dick and Ginger. You know, and there was always this, well, you need to understand, Dick carried a weapon had a huge black beard and worked for the DA as an investigator. And he had a big badge. And, I mean, he was the one you did not want coming to your door to ask questions. He was intimidating. So we, one day, had something going at church, and being bold and zealous like I was, knowing we needed to invite them, I said, "Barb, we need to invite Dick and Ginger. Go over and do it." She did. She went. And then, you know what? Dick answers the door. I don't know. Did Dick answer or Ginger? No, you came back because you talked to him. But anyway, you know, one of them answered the door. Ginger was taller than me. She was a very tall lady. We said, "Would you like to come? We have this Christmas program." And they said, "We'd love to come." Really? She came back and she says, "They said yes." I said, "Just like that?" Yeah. So they came. Within 2-3 weeks, they had accepted the Lord. It wasn't us sitting down with them. It was coming and just hearing the gospel being presented. Saying, we need to make that decision. We need our daughter growing up in this church. But you know what happened after that? They invited all their family and they came. I don't know. I think there was about 14, 15 people that accepted the Lord in the process of them just inviting family. I don't know where it ended up because shortly after that, we were over at Bethel. I graduated from seminary and everything else, and we kind of exchanged Christmas cards, but we lost contact. But, you know, it wasn't some great evangelistic movement or anything like that. We just sent Barb over to invite. And that's it. I'm going to take all the credit because I told her to go. But you know, that's just what we need to be about. We need to understand our daily business takes us to many places. Most of those places have people. You know, most of the places we go on a daily basis, there's people. That's where the command, go, is fulfilled, because we're going. There's nothing magical about a move, nothing magical about plane rides, nothing magical about just saying, "Hey, would you like to come?" People are waiting just to be asked. But part of what we need to do, and Jesus is really assuming that where they are and where we are in our relationship with him, we're just going. And we're in the process. But then comes the imperative, and that is, while you are going, make disciples. And we need to understand, it's just not go and be in their midst. But there is an imperative to be strategic, to be premeditated in the sense of when an opportunity comes, we're going to step into the opportunity. It's looking for those moments that allow us just to take the next step. It's taking and helping to introduce them to Christ. And part of that making of a disciple is that introductory phase. They've got to get from point A over here of not knowing Christ to a point of standing at the foot of the cross and accepting Christ to where they're now being matured to becoming faithful followers of Christ. And we get to be in that process. And there again, it is us's with those that we rub shoulders with that have the most opportunities and the most likelihood that they're going to listen and respond. So we need to be aware that part of what the challenge is just looking to bring people along. But we're also to be engaged in this other process. I didn't lead my grandkids to the Lord. My son and my daughter-in-law had that opportunity, that privilege. Our daughter and our son-in-law with the girls and everything else. But, you know, we're always with them. And they're looking at our lives. We are still in the process of discipling them, of helping them to become what Christ wants them to be. And we talk about those types of things, and sometimes they're so, whoever the latest group of boy singers that these, you know, freshmen and eighth graders and seventh graders and fourth graders are, oh, you know, don't shake your heads. You guys were all Frankie, Bing, Rudy Valley. See, I can go back that far. But, you know, we all had those. You know, for me, it was Annette. You know, they're out there that we would just, oh. You know, we'd rush home from, we would get out of baseball practice, and then we'd ride as hard as we could to get home to see the Mickey Mouse Club. Not to see the Mickey Mouse Clubbers, we wanted to see Annette, and we were hoping she would sing that day or have more of a lead. You know, it's where we were. But we need to see ourselves as engaged in that process of taking them at the foot of the cross, taking them through that relationship, or picking them up because somebody else has brought them there, and stepping in and having a part. And we have that with our friends. We have that with our family members. We have that with even strangers. Occasionally, you'll be sitting down talking with somebody. All of a sudden, you find out that you're both Christians, and you encourage one another, strengthen one another. Sometimes it's a colleague. I worked at City of Hope for 10 years, and I was always blessed with having at least one, if not two or three Christians in the lab that I worked alongside of. And we just had a good old time with all the skeptics and the naysayers that were in there. And they would look up, and I'd be working side by side with one of them, and they'd look over, and they'd go, "You don't believe that evolution is how things happen, do you?" I said, "Oh, no." "Well, how can you be so stupid?" I said, "How can you be so foolish?" And we would talk back and forth, but I always had a colleague that would say, "I'm with Jamie." I remember one day we had a discussion going about Noah. And somebody said, "Do you believe that Noah had all the..." "Yeah." "Well, how could he..." I don't have it figured out. I mean, I got a God that's omniscient. He can figure out how to get on that ark, what he needs to get on that ark. But they were talking, and one of the guys that was involved at Pasadena Nazarene came in the lab, and they asked him some question, and he made a comment about two of every kind. And I said, "Ah, that's not quite right. There were seven of all the clean animals and two of all the unclean animals." And everybody, then they even laughed harder. And so he laughed at me too. He said, "There weren't seven." I said, "Genesis, go check it out." He came back the next day. And in front of all the others, he said, "Jamie was right." You know, so now all of a sudden they're going, "Oh, we always thought he was the expert on the Bible." But we had opportunities that would just come up. And but having that colleague, you know, having somebody with you is really part of the process that makes it easier, because there's somebody that always has your back. But we need to see ourselves sometimes out there where we're the one that's out there on the point, and we've got to take the lead. But other times, it's just maturity. I had more fun having arguments with some of the other believers, because we weren't in harmony on every theological position. There are some positions out there that have been debated for 2,000 years, and we're going to debate them until the Lord comes, and then we'll all find out what was really God's position. That all of us were probably wrong somewhere. But I remember one day with one of the gals, we're driving down Arrow Highway, coming away from the hospital towards El Monte, headed for the 605, heading for the 605 freeway. And every time we hit a stoplight, our windows are down, and we're yelling back and forth, arguing theology and all. But at the same time, there was that just kind of sharpening each other, because we knew we were going to face it. But we were in the process of helping to disciple one another, bring one another along in the faith, and to strengthen one another so that we were able to stand up in a skeptic world. And part of that is what God designs for us. This morning they talked about, well, I don't know. Jordan used the quote, "May the dust of your rabbi always fall on you forever." Did you guys get that from Jack? Well, we're on the same topic today. Security of the believer. Anyway, there's an old proverb, that Jewish proverb. that is, may the dust of your rabbi always fall upon you. And the concept is, may you, as you follow, be so close in step that as he kicks dust up from the Judean roads, it would be hitting you on your robes, and that you were always that close. And he says, that is what needs to be our position as we're following Jesus. We are so close to Jesus that as he takes a step and his foot comes up and the dust is kind of kicked up, it's kicked up across the bottom of your trousers or up to, and all that needs to be how we see ourselves, wanting to be so close to Jesus that that is happening. And then as people are being encouraged and as they walk with us, we get to the point where we are discipling the way Paul would when he writes to the Philippians. It said, not that I've already arrived, but I press on. But those things that you see in me, those points of maturity and my faith that you see in me, copy those. Be imitators of those. Don't just imitate my life. Imitate the mature Christian, the mature faithful follower points. Most of the time, Paul has said to those he was writing to, imitate God. Be faithful followers, little children of God, and all. But that one time writing to the Philippians, he says, those points of maturity in my faith that you see, strive to follow in the footsteps. And we have individuals. I can remember, and I think I told you, one time being at downtown Disney and my grandson was with me, and I turned around in a very busy store and he wasn't there, and I am in panic mode. Because this is Nathan, so we have the special needs kid. And I'm thinking, where in this store is he? And, you know, the news has not been real good. There's been all these stories of kids disappearing and all. So panic attack. I've lost my grandson. I've got to tell my kids. And I'm spinning around, and I'm going around. And finally, I go, Nathan! And I hear this voice. I'm behind you, Papa. He is this far from me. And as I went this way, he was right there. You know, and he doesn't know. I'm in panic mode. He thinks it's fun. You know, we sit down outside, and I'm going, beat. You know, I mean, that's how bad it was. He's just, and now he thinks it's funny. Papa was panicked, you know, type of a thing. But it's that kind of thing, that we want to be so close and so in touch that then when we say somebody follow us, there be the dust of Jesus' feet is being knocked back on them as well. Not that they're imitating me, but they're imitating Christ. So the discipleship is seeking to do that. When I worked at City of Hope, I worked on a piece of equipment as an ultracentrifuge. They cost just a little bit under $200,000 in that day. And you would run just these small little amounts of fluid in them. But it would run these things at 128,000 RPM. That's fast, spinning. That's faster than NASCAR cars go. They don't go around that left turn that fast. So anyway, to run this, though, they want you to be very exact. Because if it gets out of balance, that thing starts wobbling in there, and then it comes off. And when it starts bouncing inside, it's shrapnel. And I have seen the pieces of one that they deliberately caused to malfunction so they could see if the containment chambers kept everything from going out into the room where people were, which they did. So we felt good about that. But the biggest chunk was about the size of a lemon on something that started out this big. It just, you know, and shredded the insides of the machine. So they tell us these stories, and then Dr. Riggs says, you can come up to our lab and use our machine. I said, will you teach me? He said, yeah. I said, okay. I come in, and I've got my notebook, and I've got my pen, and I'm walking with him, and he says, we go over. So I walk over, and he's doing something, and I'm writing down, and he goes over here. I go over, and I'm writing down, and he comes over here, and he sets something down inside on the spindle, and he's getting ready to start adding samples. I'm writing down, and then he walks over here, and I'm right over here, and he looks over. He says, what are you doing? I said, I'm just following you and doing everything. He says, I'm getting a cup of coffee. I wrote it down. I thought maybe you have to have a cup of coffee at that point. But he was teaching me how to use that. Eventually came the day he said, here's the key to that room. Come up and use it anytime. I have complete confidence. The next time I go up, I am scared to death. And he is not in the building. He's at some seminar, and I'm using it for the first time by myself. hyperventilation time. But, you know, that's the concept of making disciples, is that they are just following. And I literally, if there had been anything on the floor, he'd been kicking it up against me, and my lab coat would have been splattered with whatever it was. But we need to see that that's the process of helping mature people. And then it goes on from there, and it says that part of that whole process is first becoming a follower, accepting and learning about Christ, and then becoming an example of what that means by becoming one who hears what Jesus said, who then studies to understand what Jesus says, and then begins to practice and obey what Jesus said. And as we do that, then we get a handle on the teaching of Christ, and we understand what's all involved with that. And that gets us to the next step, which is, as you're doing all this, then you also need to be involved in the process of teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. So there's that sense that we are teachers as well. As we're going to help lead them along, we need to be putting into them the information that they need. And it's a focus on Jesus' commands, not on the Old Testament law and not on being under law, but it's the idea of being a faithful follower of Jesus and living under the grace that comes into our life as we accept him. And that, again, gets back to learning how to take what Jesus has taught and to get it into others' lives and then help them understand how to apply it, how to obey it. And the reality is Christianity spreads by the internalizing of the message of Jesus, by helping understand what Jesus taught, by helping understand why Jesus came, by helping understand the death, the burial, the resurrection of Jesus, and seeing that become so woven into their life that it becomes the very fabric of their life. And then they begin to obey and to follow and to serve and to seek to bring others in and to have them walk and to follow after him. We begin and are engaged in the process of writing or engraving the tenets of Jesus on the hearts of others. And that's what a lot of us like to do. That's the thing that lights my jets. I love it when I see individuals come to know the Lord. This next coming Sunday morning, there's, I think, two individuals at 9:30 that are going to be baptized that have become Christians in the last couple of years and all that are going to follow the Lord in baptism. And you know, that whole process is exciting. But then it really lights my jets when they get from that point and they start saying, I want to get engaged in ministry. I want to be a teacher. I want to go on a mission trip with the high school team. I want to go to Guatemala. I want to go with the group, and we're hoping that down the road that if this opens up with Burma, with Myanmar, that we're going to have maybe groups of four, five going three or four times a year. We'll have a small team over there serving and ministering and helping to do this very thing. But it may be that it's being with a team that we have yet to really think through all the possibilities of. But we've got two individuals that are on the ground in countries in Africa that we could network with and send teams to Africa. We don't know where all this is going to end up. But we know that God has a heart that is global. And he has a heart that's the size of Orange County and L.A. County, and the size of La Mirada and La Habra and the city you live in. And he has a heart the size of the block that you live on. And in all those places, this is what he's been calling us to do. And we just need to figure out how does that all work itself out. But we need to seek to write on the hearts of individuals that which is eternal, that which will not return empty or without fruit. And God has called us to do that, and he's instructing the disciples. And next week, we're actually, take a guess where we're going to be next week. Okay. Acts. What chapter? Oh, no, that's Tuesday. No, next Sunday night, we're gonna pick up Acts chapter 1, verse 8. But that is just kind of, he gives this commission, And then next week, we're going to look at the whole process that in the midst of it, he's told us again, not only to be going and discipling and teaching and baptizing and everything else, but that we're to be his person, his witness. So we're going to look at that. But in the midst of all this, it's just the imperative to be on task. Really, Jesus is saying, you got a life that you need to live with significance, and that significance is found in me, and it's found in sharing me, and it's found in helping people mature in me, and then allowing them. Some of the greatest rewards that I have seen in ministry for me personally is when I've got kids that have gone through the high school group, and then they went through our college group, and then they come up to me and they say, can I get engaged in the ministry? And I said, you bet. And I'd stick them off starting in junior high, because I wanted to have 4 to 5 years between high school, if they grew up in the high school group, and themselves, so that it's not their buddies. I've seen it where their buddies were in the group, and they manipulate you as an advisor. So we start them down younger and let them move up with the group and stuff like that. I've got kids to this day that will send me texts and say, I'm doing this in my church now. And I'm taking a group to camp, and they'll come back from camp, and they'll say, I had two boys come to know the Lord. And they're so excited about it. And I'm excited because Rex was excited. And I'm excited because Jake and Jason came to know the Lord. You know, whatever. It's this whole global thing that we're involved in our walk with God, is that we're on task and on purpose and, you know. And it's an imperative that it happens. And let me give you a reason. This comes out of Leadership Magazine. It's one of those magazines that I have taken for years. And it came out of the first volume. So this is 25 years ago, maybe, that this volume was. And these numbers were current then. They're worse today. They didn't get better in the time in between. 19 out of every 20 who become Christians do so before they reach the age of 24. After 25, only 1 in 10,000. After 35, only 1 in 40,000. After 45, only 1 in 200,000. After 55, only 1 in 300,000. After 65, only 1.5 million. After 74, only 1 in 700,000 come to know the Lord. Now, if we don't change those statistics by being engaged in the process, it's a tragedy. We've got to be involved. We've got to look for the other. We just got to make ourselves available to what the Lord wants to do each day and who he brings across our paths. And just engage them and say, hey, Dick, Ginger, you want to go to something we're having at church during the Christmas season? And we never know what that person becomes and how they turn out. But we need to be, and I tell you once again, that's a struggle area for me. I get caught up in my tasks here, the administrative things. And it's really easy for me to never get outside the walls if I'm not careful. It's easy to kind of get diverted. Or to only do Tuesday morning and Sunday night and hospital calls and not see the other times. And we live in a world where we live in our backyards. When I used to go back to my aunt and uncles, everybody lived in their backyards, but nobody had fences. So you went down and you met at the corner where all four houses came together, and the kids played in these giant playgrounds. And now we've got big, and if I could do it, I'd have a mold around the outside. That's a tendency, is we tend to sequester ourselves inside our castle instead of all my Hispanic neighbors. They live in their front yard. I go, why would you live in your front yard? Somebody might stop and talk to you. That's where I've met my neighbors. Something would be happening, I'd go over and visit with them and start getting to know them. One of those things, the disciples, they are just getting ready to have their minds blown and to turn the world upside down. Let's pray. God, go with us, direct us, guide us as we walk this week, help us to live faithfully for Christ. And just help us to be available as you would give us opportunity. We pray this in his name. Amen.